Chapter 7. When Isaac Bell telephoned Marion Morgan to tell her he had 1 hour free in San Francisco before he caught his train to Sacramento, and could she possibly get off work early, Marion replied, "Meet me at the clock." The great Magneta clock, the first master clock west of the Mississippi, which had come around the Horn by steamship, was famous already, even though it had been installed in the St. Francis Hotel only the week before. Dominating the Powell Street lobby of the St. Francis, the ornately carved Viennese timepiece resembled a very large grandfather clock and looked somewhat old-fashioned in the European mode. But it was, in fact, electrically powered, and it automatically controlled all the clocks in the vast hotel that towered over Union Square. The lobby was furnished with suites of chairs and couches arranged on oriental carpets. Parchment and glass-shaded electric lamps cast a warm glow, which was reflected and multiplied in gilt mirrors. The air smelled sweetly of sawn wood and fresh paint. 18 months after the fires ignited by the great earthquake had gutted its interior, San Francisco's newest and grandest hotel was open for business, with 480 rooms and a new wing planned for the following spring. It had instantly become the most popular hotel in the city. Most of the chairs and couches were occupied by paying guests reading newspapers. The headlines blared the latest rumors about the labor agitators and foreign radicals who had ditched the Coastline Limited. Marion swept into the lobby first, so excited to see Isaac that she was oblivious to the open stares of admiration she drew from various gentlemen as they watched her pace before the clock. She wore her straw blonde hair high on her head, a fashionable style that drew attention to her long, graceful neck and the beauty of her face. Her waist was narrow, her hands delicate, and judging how she seemed to flow across the carpet, the legs beneath her full skirt were long. Her coral sea green eyes flashed toward the clock as the minute hand inched upright, and the great Magneta struck three mighty gongs that resounded so much like the bells of a cathedral that they seemed to shake the walls. 1 minute later, Isaac strode into the lobby, tall and ruggedly handsome in a cream-colored woolen sack suit, crisp blue fold-collar shirt, and the gold-striped necktie she had given him that matched his flaxen hair and mustache. She was so delighted by the sight of him that all she could think to say was, "I've never seen you late before." Isaac smiled back as he opened his gold pocket watch. "The great Magneta is 60 seconds fast." He let his eyes roam over her, saying, "And I've never seen you prettier." Then he swept her into his arms and kissed her. He guided her to a pair of chairs where he could watch the entire lobby with the aid of several mirrors, and they ordered tea with lemon cake from a waiter in a tailcoat. "What are you looking at?" Belle asked. She was staring at him with a soft smile on her beautiful face. "You turned my life upside down." "That was the earthquake," he teased her. "Before the earthquake. The earthquake was only an interruption." Ladies Marion Morgan's age were supposed to have married years before, but she was a level-headed woman who enjoyed her independence. At 30, with years of experience supporting herself working as a senior secretary in the banking business, she had lived on her own since graduating with her law degree from Stanford University. The handsome, wealthy suitors who had begged for her hand in marriage had all been disappointed. Perhaps it was the air of San Francisco, so filled with endless possibilities, that gave her courage. Perhaps it was her education by hand-picked tutors and her loving father after her mother died. Perhaps it was living in modern times, the excitement of being alive in the bold first years of the new century. But something had filled her with confidence and a rare ability to take real pleasure in the circumstance of being alone. That is, until Isaac Bell walked into her life and made her heart quicken as if she were 17 years old and on her first date. "I am so lucky," she thought. Isaac took Marion's hand. For a long moment he found it difficult to speak. Her beauty, her poise, and her grace never failed to move him. Staring into her green eyes, he finally said, I am the happiest man in San Francisco. And if we were in New York right now, I would be the happiest man in New York. She smiled and looked away. When she looked back to meet his eyes, she saw that his gaze had shifted to a newspaper headline. Ditched. Train wrecks were a part of daily life in 1907, but to have a Los Angeles Flyer crash and knowing that Isaac rode trains all the time was terrifying. Oddly, she worried less about the dangers in his work. They were real, and she had seen his scars. But to worry about Isaac encountering gunmen and knife fighters would be as irrational as fretting about a tiger's safety in the jungle. He was staring at the paper, his face dark with anger. She touched his hand. Isaac, is that train wreck about your case? Yes. It's at least the fifth attack. But there is something in your face, something fierce, that tells me it is very personal. Do you remember when I told you about Wish Clark? Of course. He saved your life. I hope to meet him one day to thank him personally. The man who wrecked that train killed Wish, Belle said coldly. Oh, Isaac, I'm so sorry. With that, Belle filled her in, as was his custom with her, detailing all he knew of the wrecker's attacks on Osgood Hennessy's Southern Pacific Cascades cutoff and how he was trying to stop them. Marion had a keen analytical mind. She could focus on pertinent facts and see patterns early in their development. Above all, she raised critical questions that honed his own thinking. Motive is still an open question, he concluded. What ulterior motive is driving him to such destruction? Do you believe the theory that the wrecker is a radical? Marion asked. The evidence is there. His accomplices, the radical poster, even the target. The railroad is a prime villain to radicals. You sound dubious, Isaac. I am, he admitted. I've tried to put myself in his shoes, tried to think like an angry agitator. But I still can't imagine the wholesale slaughter of innocent people. In the heat of a riot or in a strike, they might attack the police. While I will not condone such violence, I can understand how a man's thinking gets twisted. But this relentless attack on ordinary people, such viciousness makes no sense. Could he be a madman? A lunatic? He could. Except that he is remarkably ambitious and methodical for a lunatic. These are not impulsive attacks. He plans them meticulously. And he plans his escape just as carefully. If it's madness, it's under fine control. He may be an anarchist. I know. But why kill so many people? In fact, he mused, it's almost as if he is trying to sow terror. But what does he gain by sowing terror? Marion answered, the public humiliation of the Southern Pacific Railroad Company. He is certainly achieving that, said Bell. Maybe instead of thinking like a radical or an anarchist or a madman, you should think like a banker. What do you mean? He looked at her, uncomprehending. Marion answered in a clear, steady voice. Imagine what it is costing Osgood Hennessy. Belle nodded thoughtfully. The irony of thinking like a banker was not lost on a man who had turned his back on an obligatory career in his own family's powerful bank. He touched her cheek. Thank you, he said. You've given me a lot to ponder. I'm relieved, said Marion, and teasingly added, I'd rather you ponder than get into gunfights. I like gunfights, Belle bantered back. They focus the mind. Though in this case, we may be talking about sword fights. Sword fights? It's very strange. He killed Wish and another man with what appears to be some kind of sword. The question is, how does he get the drop on a man with a gun? You can't hide a sword. What about a sword cane? Plenty of men in San Francisco carry sword canes for protection. But just unsheathing it, drawing the blade out of the cane, would give a man with a gun all the time he needed to shoot first. Well, if he comes after you with a sword, he'll be sorry. You fenced for Yale. Bell shook his head with a smile. Fenced, not dueled. There's a big difference between sport and combat. I recall my coach, who had been a duelist, explaining that the fencing mask hides your opponent's eyes. As he put it, the first time you fight a duel, you were shocked to meet the cold gaze of a man who intends to kill you. Were you? Was I what? Shocked. She smiled. Don't pretend to me you've never fought a duel. Bell smiled back. Only once. We were both very young, and the sight of spurting red blood soon convinced us that we didn't really want to kill each other. In fact, we're still friends. If you're looking for a duelist, there can't be too many of them left in this day and age. Likely a European, mused Bell. Italian or French. Or German, with one of those horrible Heidelberg scars on his cheek. Didn't Mark Twain write that they pulled the surgeon's stitches apart and poured wine in their wounds to make the scars even uglier? Probably not a German, said Bell. They're known for the plunging blow. The thrust that killed Wish and the other fellow was more in the style of an Italian or a Frenchman. Or the student of, Marion suggested. An American who went to school in Europe? There are plenty of anarchists in France and Italy. Maybe that's where he became one. I still don't know how he takes a man with a gun by surprise. He demonstrated with a gesture. In the time it takes to draw a sword, you can step in and punch him in the nose. Marion reached across the teacups and took Bell's hand. To tell the truth, I would be delighted if a bloody nose is the most I have to worry about. At this point, I would love a bloody nose, or even a flesh wound or two. Whatever for? You remember Weber and Fields? The funny old gents. Wally Kisley and Mac Fulton had taken her to dinner while passing through San Francisco recently and kept her laughing all evening. Wally and Mac always say bloody noses are a sure sign of progress. You know you're close when your quarry pokes you in the snoot. Right now I could use a good poke in the snoot. The comment brought a smile to their faces. Two women, fashionably dressed in the latest hats and gowns, entered the hotel lobby and crossed it in a flourish of feathers and silk. The younger was so striking that many of the lowered newspapers remained on their owner's laps. Marion said, "What a beautiful girl." Bell had already seen her in a mirror. "The girl wearing pale blue," said Marion. "She is Osgood Hennessy's daughter Lillian," said Bell, wondering if it was coincidence that had brought Lillian to the St. Francis while he was here, and suspecting it was not. "Do you know her?" "I met her last week aboard Hennessy's special. She's his private secretary."
"What is she like?"
Bell smiled. "She has pretensions to being a seductress. Flashes her eyes like that French actress."
Anna held.
"She is intelligent, though, and savvy about business. She's very young, spoiled by her adoring father, and, I suspect, very innocent when it comes to matters of the heart. The dark-haired woman with her used to be her tutor. Now she's Hennessy's mistress."
"Do you want to go over and say hello?"
"Not when I have only minutes left to spend with you." Marion returned a pleased grin.
"I am flattered.
She is young, unspeakably beautiful, and presumably very rich." "You are unspeakably beautiful, and when you marry me, you will be very rich, too."
"But I'm not an heiress."
"I've known my fill of heiresses, thank you very much, since we were taught the Boston Waltz in dancing school," he said, grinning back. "It's a slow waltz with a long glide. We can dance it at our wedding, if you like.
Oh, Isaac, are you sure you want to marry me?
I am sure. Most people would call me an old maid, and they would say that a man your age should marry a girl her age. I've never done what I should do. Why should I start now when I've finally met the girl of my dreams and made a friend for life?
But what will your family think of me? I have no money. They'll think I'm a gold digger.
They will think I am the luckiest man in America. Isaac smiled, but then he added soberly, "Any who don't can go straight to hell. Shall we set a date?"
Isaac, I have to talk to you.
What is it? Is something the matter?
I am deeply in love with you. I hope you know that.
You show me in every way.
And I want ever so much to marry you. But I wonder if we could wait a little while.
Why?
I've been offered an exciting job, and it is something I would like to try very much.
What sort of job?
Well, you know who Preston Whiteway is, of course.
Of course. Preston Whiteway is a yellow journalist who inherited three of California's leading newspapers, including the San Francisco Inquirer. He gave her a curious smile. The newspaper you happen to work for. He's said to be quite handsome and a celebrated man about town, and he flaunts his wealth, which he earns publishing sensationalist headlines. He's also sunk his hooks into national politics by using the power of his newspapers to get his friends appointed to the United States Senate. First among them, Osgood Hennessy's lapdog legislator, Senator Charles Kincaid. In fact, I believe that it was your Mr. Whiteway who gave Kincaid the moniker Hero Engineer.
He's not my Mr. Whiteway, but... Oh, Isaac, he has a wonderful new idea. He came up with it while the paper was reporting on the earthquake. A moving picture newsreel. He's calling it Picture World. They'll take moving pictures of actual events and play them in theaters and Nickelodeons. And Isaac, she gripped his arm in her excitement, Preston asked me to help get it started.
For how long?
I'm not sure. 6 months or a year?
Isaac, I know I can do this, and this man will give me a chance to try.
You know that I took my degree in law in Stanford's first graduating class, but a woman can't get a job in law, which is why I've worked 9 years in banking. I've learned so much. It's not that I want to work my whole life, but I want to make something, and this is my chance to make something.
Bell was not surprised by Marion's desire to work at an exciting job, nor did he doubt their love. They were both too well aware of their great good fortune at having discovered each other to ever let someone come between them. Some sort of a compromise was in order, and he could not deny that he had his own hands full trying to stop the wrecker. What if we were to promise that in 6 months we would set a date to marry? When things have settled down, you can still work and be married.
Oh, Isaac, that would be wonderful. I so much want to be in at the beginning of Picture World.
The bells of the magnetic clock began to strike 4 o'clock.
I wish we had more time, she said sadly.
It seemed to Bell like only minutes since they had sat down. I'll drive you to your office. He noticed that Lillian Hennessy was looking pointedly the other way as they left the lobby. But Mrs. Comden parted her lips in a discreet smile as their eyes met. He returned a polite nod, struck again forcibly by the woman's sensuality, and gripped Marion's arm a little tighter. A fire engine red, gasoline-powered locomobile racer was parked directly in front of the St. Francis. It was modified for street traffic with fenders and searchlight headlamps. The hotel doormen were guarding the car from gawking small boys, threatening dire punishment to the first who dared lay dirty fingers on the gleaming brass eagle atop its radiator,
much less breathe near its red leather seats.
You got your race car back.
It's beautiful, said Marion, showing her delight. Belle's beloved locomobile had been beaten half to death by a 500-mile race against a locomotive from San Francisco to San Diego, with the locomotive steaming on smooth rails and the locomobile pounding over California's rock-strewn dirt roads. A race, Belle remembered with a grim smile, that he had won. His trophy had been the arrest of the Butcher Bandit at gunpoint. As soon as the factory rebuilt it, I had it shipped out here from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Hop in. Belle leaned past the big steering wheel to turn the ignition switch on the wooden dashboard. He set the throttle and spark levers. Then he pumped the pressure tank. The doorman offered to crank the motor. Still warm from the drive from the freight depot where Belle had taken delivery, the four-cylinder engine thundered to life on the first heave. Belle advanced the spark and eased the throttle. As he reached to release the brake, he beckoned the smallest of the boys who were watching big-eyed.
"Can you give me a hand? She can't roll without blowing her horn."
The boy squeezed the big rubber horn bulb with both hands. The locomobile bellowed like a Rocky Mountain bighorn. Boys scattered. The car lurched ahead. Marion laughed and leaned across the gas tank to hold Belle's arm. Soon they were racing toward Market Street, weaving around straining horse carts and streetcars and thundering past slower automobiles. As they pulled up in front of the 12-story steel-frame building that housed the San Francisco Inquirer, Belle spotted the last parking space left by the curb. A fair-haired gent in an open Rolls-Royce veered toward it, blowing his horn.
"Oh, there's Preston. You can meet him."
"Can't wait," said Belle, stomping his accelerator and brake in quick succession to skid the big locomobile into the last spot, a half-second ahead of Preston Whiteway's Rolls.
"Hey, that's my spot."
Belle noticed that Whiteway was as handsome as rumored, a bluff, broad-shouldered, clean-shaven man with extravagant waves of blonde hair. As tall as Belle, though considerably bulkier in the middle, he looked like he had played football in college and could not recall the last time he had not had his way.
"I got here first," said Belle.
"I own this building.
You can have it back after I say goodbye to my girl." Now Preston Whiteway craned his neck to look past Belle and bawled,
"Marion, is that you?"
"Yes, this is Isaac. I want you to meet him."
"Pleased to meet you," said Preston Whiteway, looking anything but.
"Marion, we better get upstairs. We've got work to do."
"You go ahead," she said coolly. "I want to say goodbye to Isaac."
Whiteway leaped from his car, bellowing for the doorman to park it. As he charged past, he asked Belle, "How fast is your locomobile?"
"Faster than that," said Belle, nodding at the Rolls-Royce.
Marion covered her mouth to keep from laughing, and when Whiteway had moved out of earshot, she said to Belle, "You two sounded like boys in a schoolyard.
How could you be jealous of Preston?
He's really very nice. You'll like him when you get to know him."
"I'm sure," said Belle.
He took her beautiful face gently in his hands and kissed her lips.
"Now you take care of yourself."
"Me?"
"You take care of yourself.
Please, take care of yourself."
She forced a smile.
"Maybe you should bone up on your sword fighting."
"I intend to."
"Oh, Isaac, I wish we had more time."
"I'll get back as soon as I can."
"I love you, my darling."
High above the Cascades cut-off construction yard, a single gondola car had been left behind on a siding. It sat a short distance above the switch that, when closed, would connect the siding to the steep grade of a supply spur that connected the railroad's newly built lumber mill in the forest miles up the mountain to the construction yard below. The car was heavily laden, heaped higher than its sides with a crown of freshly sawn mountain hemlock cross ties bound for the cutoff's creosoting plant to be impregnated with coal tar preservative. The wrecker saw an opportunity to strike again, sooner than he had planned, killing two birds with one stone. This attack would rattle not only the Southern Pacific Railroad. If he could pull it off, it would announce how immune he was from the protective efforts of the Van Dorn Detective Agency. He was a coldly methodical man. He had planned the tunnel attack meticulously, allotting time to every stage, from recruiting an accomplice with the ideal mix of zeal and naivete, to pinpointing the geologically propitious location for the dynamite, to planning his escape route. The coastline limited attack had taken similar efforts, including using a hook to make it obvious that the destruction was sabotage, not a mere accident. He had similar schemes for wreckage lined up, in various stages of readiness, although some of them had to be scrapped now that the Van Dorn detectives were guarding key rail yards and maintenance shops. But not every sabotage job had to be planned. The railroad system that crisscrossed the nation was immensely complex. Opportunities for destruction abounded, so long as he employed his superior knowledge to be ever alert to mistakes and negligence. So long as he moved quickly and did the unexpected. The gondola would remain only briefly on the siding. With 2,700 ties required per mile of track, it could not be more than a day or two before a hard-pressed materials superintendent down in the yard roared, "Where the hell are the rest of my ties?" And terrified clerks began desperately combing through invoices and dispatches for the missing car. The nearest hobo jungle big enough that he would not be noticed, in a crush of men cooking meals, hunting a space to sleep, and coming and going on their endless quest for work, was outside the rail yards in Dunsmuir, California. But Dunsmuir was 150 miles down the line. That left no time to recruit a believer. He would have to do the gondola job himself. There was risk in attacking alone, and risk in attacking quickly. But the destruction he could wreak with that single car was almost incalculable.